This is Games as a Podcast. Today, we're super excited to have a guest, Mark Solucci, a gentleman I've known for many moons. We used to work together back in the olden Sega days. So Ethan and I go way back to Sega of America. Mark and I go back just a little bit further. So we built some really cool stuff for Sega.com, and we've remained friends for many, many years. Mark moved to Japan to study Japanese, and he never left. He's worked at some of the biggest Japanese game developers and also as an entrepreneur, building his own company with many gaming clients. Mark, it's really cool to have you here today. If you'd love to hear a little bit about your journey, then get into the discussion.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, gentlemen. I'm Mark. Nice to talk to everybody. I mean, Chris covered big hits, but I used to work for Sega of America. Well, Sega.com. Started in 1999, back in the ye olde Dreamcast days, working on a bunch of web stuff, but kind of felt the urge to learn Japanese while I was still young. So I left and went to Japan and studied Japanese full-time for a couple years. Then I had a small stint at Koei as a marketing manager, of all things. And then got the call to go back to the Sega mothership at AM3, the arcade division, to be a producer of arcade games. Then about 15 years ago, I branched off and did my own thing, started a small app development company, and I'm still here. I'm still kicking. And that's the Cliff Notes.
Excellent. Like you, Ethan and I are Sega fans, so I expect Ethan's got questions aplenty. But why don't you first start by talking about your experience at Koei and how that differed from working at Sega?
Sega is, like you can see it in their games, Sega is kind of a loose, like almost carefree, or used to be anyway, kind of, you know, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see if it sticks. Koei is just like their games in that they've got a lot of historical games with, like, you know, the Shoguns and all that. And that's exactly how that company is structured. They've got a Shogun at the top. Her name is Keiko Edikawa. And she's a battle axe, man. She walks through the halls and people are practically bowing, you know, they are bowing in the Japanese sense. It's just run like a Shogun era, you know, Warring States era company. So it's a trip, whereas Sega is much more, I don't want to say normal, but compared to that, yeah, it's much more normal.
So I have a question about that, too. The games that were most popular at Koei were very Japanese-centric,
yeah.
Clearly made for a Japanese audience, whereas you look at Sega in the time that you were there, and even before that, the real success Sega was having in many cases was in Western markets. Sonic is hugely popular, but that's because of American kids, not Japanese kids.
Right.
Whereas the Koei stuff, the Dynasty Warriors, all of that, that is really very squarely rooted in traditional Japanese lore. What was the difference working for a company in one case where all of their fortunes and their focus was on Japanese players making games in Japan, and then on Sega's side, there was such a clear concentration on being big in the West?
Yeah. I think in both cases, you know, trying to, for example, Sega trying to be big in the West, well, they were trying to be big in Japan, too. It just didn't work out. And Koei, for many years, they always had, like, even back in the NES days, they were putting out, you know, Romance of the Three Kingdoms or Nobunaga's Ambition, which most people called Nobunga's Ambition, right? You know, and they tried, but their stuff was too niche. But then, you know, Dynasty Warriors happened, and that it was such a showcase for the PlayStation 2, you know, because you're just weed whacking through tons of dudes, and it just, there was nothing like it at the time. And so that's how they got their success in the West. And then after that, they kept trying to push it, and they kept trying to, we localized all sorts of historical simulations, and none of them hit, you know, it's just not the market. But the Warrior series has been consistent. One of the reasons for that consistency, and this is important in the Japanese market, is that they don't change the formula, like, at all. You know, you look at Dragon Quest or, you know, a lot of these games, these series, they don't really mix it up. And the Warrior series, man, you should see the people who make these games. They look bored out of their minds. Because they're just sitting there doing the same maps, and okay, we'll put, you know, an army here and an army here. It sells. It sells every time, consistently. More so in Japan than in the West, but it still sells. So, you know.
That's very interesting to hear. It kind of reminds me, Ethan, of our podcast last week where we were talking about the importance of the first-time user experience, player experience, and the elements of it. And the first two elements were something that is familiar and then something that is, what's your hook? Something that's different to kind of draw the player in to get them interested. How do you feel, Mark, or what is the difference between your stereotypical Japanese gamer and a Western gamer? Do their tastes vary that drastically? Is there a reason that these games are always the same? It's because the Japanese consumer always expects them to be the same?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people about that, because when I was at Koei, I was like, how can y'all like the same thing over and over again? You know, whereas in the West, you know, for example, Tomb Raider came out and it was awesome. Tomb Raider 2, okay, this is cool. Tomb Raider 3, yeah. Tomb Raider 4, you know, and then it killed the franchise for a while. And what people would tell me is that, you know, it's like when they play the next Dragon Quest, it's like coming home. It's like, you know, a warm blanket. It's like they know what's going to happen. They don't have to worry about it. And this is one thing that Final Fantasy is different. And like, they always do something different. And it still sells too. But the vast majority of Japanese gamers want that kind of warm blanket. You know, after a long day of work, they want to come home and just hack through thousands of little samurais and have that be it.
You know, well, and with Final Fantasy, that's why I was asking about kind of the global versus local approach. Because Dragon Quest XI is a great game, but it is very traditional, to your point.
Yeah.
You have this strong feeling like it was made principally with Japanese audiences in mind, and you can imagine that there are Japanese businessmen in their 50s who are just so nostalgic about that experience, and that's what they want, and they don't want it changed. Whereas, by contrast, Final Fantasy, which clearly is more global in its approach, Final Fantasy 16 really feels a lot more like Devil May Cry than it does traditional Final Fantasy. So they're trying to expand their audience, whereas it seems like Dragon Quest is trying to just cater to the audience they know better than anyone in the world.
That's true, and they're just doing what sells. Dragon Quest has never been a big seller in the West, but it prints money in Japan, so, you know, keep it traditional. Whereas Final Fantasy, it's bigger in the West, so they mix it up. Pretty much that simple.
You know, one thing that is a great benefit, though, to focusing on what you know and iterating instead of trying to do something totally new, is that they do end up becoming best in class in creating certain types of games. So when you do play a game like Bayonetta, say, this is something that has come from a team of people that did work on Devil May Cry prior. And so they come to the table understanding all the nuances and intricacies of that kind of fighting game, that type of battle system. And so it just feels so much more fluid, so much better than, say, a Ninja Theory coming in and doing something similar for the first time.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And if there's constant iteration, and then you also make a new IP out of it, then that's one thing. When you're talking about the Warriors games, and I don't want to be slagging Koei all day. I could. And there's lots of stories about Koei. The formula does not change at all. For example, Samurai Warriors 15 is going to be basically 14 with a couple new characters, and that's it. That's the pattern. There's a limit to where that works well, and then it gets oversaturated, at least for the West. Japan can put up with a lot more when it comes to having the same old, same old.
Do they put them out every year, or do they come out when they're ready?
Warriors used to be pretty much yearly, or every 2 years, and then what they do is they bridge the gap with expansion packs. They put out like an Empires thing. They sell that for $30-$40, and it's the same thing just with like a strategy mode. And then they put out another one, you know, so they fill the gap. Koei is very intelligent when it comes to making money. The owners of Koei, they're like in the top, I want to say 20 richest people in all of Japan. They own like a golf course in Hawaii, I think it is.
Why not?
So yeah, it's but what's funny is like, so the battle axe I mentioned before, Keiko Erikawa, who's, I always got along well with her until, you know, when I told her I was going to Sega. Well, that's another story.
Huh.
But she's a trip, because she runs her empire. She'll walk through, and she's just, you know, she has never made a video game in her life, but she's been around it. She'll walk into like the group that's doing computer graphics. The moment she walks in, everybody gets all tightened up, and then she'll come up to somebody screaming like, "That's not how you animate a character. You should move this here and there, nah, nah, nah," like that. And that's how she talks too. So my one encounter in working with her was, somebody found out in Koei that I could sing. Right, I think it probably through karaoke or something. And they asked me to sing on a demo trailer for a game that eventually came out many years later called Neo, which I'm sure you've
heard. Oh yeah, of. Team Ninja.
But before, this was before the merger, way before, like back in 2007, they wanted to put out a trailer at TGS, and it was all CG. There was no game to it. They asked me to sing a demo for the real singer so that they can hear the English part of the song. So I go in and I sing it, and you know, it's just a demo, right? The director and the producer, the engineer, they're all like, yeah, giving me the classic thumbs up, right? But she comes in, she wanted to hear it. I did it, and she's like, no, Mark, you have to sing from the diaphragm. You know, she's got this jack kind of voice. And she's telling me, like, from down here.
I just picture her with, like, a cigarette hanging out of her mouth or something.
Basically. I mean, she definitely has that, you know, three packs a day kind of mellifluous, honey-toned voice. And she tells me, no, I'll do it again. And I did it again. Little more, come on. And I did it the exact same. It took about two or three times. I didn't change a thing. The final take, she was like, that's it, you got it, all right. And then that was it. So yeah, so that was my one encounter with her. So she's kind of in her own world, but she makes ridiculous amounts of money doing it.
Well, that's something I'd love to know too, between Sega and Koei and the other places you've worked at in Japan, what the boss culture is like.
Yeah.
So when I was at Sega, well, Chris was my boss and he was willing to listen. He's empathetic, right? On the other end, when we were setting up for E3 one year and somehow journalists got word early about Phantasy Star Universe, that was a time when Yuji Naka, who is not such an empathetic boss, got wind of that. He brought us into a back room, lined up, and I was really nervous. And, you know, we had a coworker, a guy named Yosuke, and I was standing right next to him, and Yuji Naka just starts screaming at us in Japanese. And I asked Yosuke very quietly, what is he saying? And Yosuke said, dude, you don't want to know. And then it was a very dramatic, like, literal moving of the table to make everything fall onto the ground, and then Yuji Naka left the room. It was quite the show. But you just described kind of a rough boss culture with Koei. Is that typical out there?
No, not at all. I think back in the day, you'd have more of you know, people who could, you know, bosses who could get away with yelling at you. Now Japan is much stricter about power harassment rules and even overtime rules. It's gotten a lot better. The thing is, it's all about personalities. Like, if Yuji Naka hadn't, you know, sold, if his games hadn't sold, he wouldn't be able to get away with that. Nobody would put up with
it. Okay.
You know, it's simply that. And, you know, with Erikawa-san, she was never mean about it. She was always like, you know, she wasn't yelling at people at all. She just thought she knew how to do everything, and maybe she did, who knows. But for example, Yuji Naka would not, he wouldn't get away with that crap. For example, my bosses at Sega were never like that. My direct boss could be an asshole sometimes, and I told him that once. I got tired of his you know, he could be condescending to people, usually not me, but I sat him aside and was like, you know, you're kind of an asshole. And he laughed. He was like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. You got me. You know, it just depends on the person. Really.
Okay. Yeah, I got a much gentler version of that at one point. And Chris, you may or may not remember this, but we were called into a special meeting for a game called Kingdom Conquest 2, which was performing a lot worse than it was supposed to. And I was the one in charge of it. And so the person in charge in Japan had his translator ask on the VidCon, you said that the numbers were going to be way up here. The numbers are way down here. What happened? And I explained, and he said, okay, thank you. I understand. But you said the numbers are going to be way up here, and the numbers are way down here. What happened? And this repeated for 2 hours.
Ooh, fun.
And I was just coming up with different answers. He didn't yell. He didn't raise his voice. But after that was done, one of our peers, a guy named Ken, who grew up in Japan and was working in the Western office, I asked him, what happened there? And Ken just said, oh, he was shaming you. And so that apparently was what was happening in that case. You know, how do people in Japan in leadership positions express disdain or frustration? Is there kind of a common set of ways that manifests itself, or is it different for every manager like anywhere else?
It's different. I think what you experienced there is not necessarily uncommon, where you'll get asked the same question over and over again. It's not them coming out and saying, like, you know, you screwed up. It's them kind of making you say that you screwed up.
Ah, right? Okay.
Yeah. So that happens, but it really just depends. I mean, I've had managers or clients or what have you that you just explain, man, here's what happened. Okay, got it. Let's try something else. And then there's some who just can't, you know, let it go. So it's just, that kind of depends on the person too, I think.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of, we were the Western entity for the Japanese parent company. This person, Ethan, who you were talking to, was responsible for the P&L probably globally, and they didn't really have any control over the performance in the West, and knew that they were probably going to get their feet held to the fire and wanted to cover his ass, so to speak, as much as possible.
Yep.
That definitely happens. For a lot of Japanese companies, the West is like this big black box, right? You know, and a lot of them don't speak English here. So they depend on their middle managers the middle managers have to bring reasons why things aren't working. And if they don't fully understand why it's not working, or you didn't meet your numbers, then they're going to look like jerks, you know, or they're going to look terrible. And part of it is probably him trying to cover his ass. And then part of it was probably a little bit of, like, poking at you.
Ah, okay. Well, one other experience I had was the rough culture shift of creating PowerPoints to speak to Japanese leadership, where I was used to just putting no more than 6 words on a page PowerPoint, right?
Yeah.
And just having it as a backdrop to kind of frame what you were saying, and your presentation was what you focused on and you rehearsed and made sure was clear and focused. So I tried that with a Japanese audience, and they were shocked. They were like, you did not give us a presentation of any kind. What is this? What's going on there?
Yeah. So, yeah, you should see some Japanese PowerPoints. You probably have, but they're just packed. They're like little novellas on each page. They put all the information that they can possibly get into it. It's not, they don't treat PowerPoint as presentation software. They treat it as a whiteboard, essentially, or you know, something like that. Whereas, and Excel is the same way. Excel is a spreadsheet application, obviously, but it's also, they do, you know, game design docs in Excel. They do everything in Excel. Word is like the least used Office suite app by far. Nobody uses Word here, which is, you know, you'd think, let's write a document. It's, you know, let's put it in Word, but no, that's...
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, my theory is that, you know, Japanese as a language is, you know, obviously it's got the kanji, the pictographic stuff, and it's very compact and very square. Everything fits in a little square. Each character fits in it's more like a rectangle. It's really easy in PowerPoint and to a degree Excel to fit rectangles in rectangles. It's almost like a printing press. You can put the stuff in, you know, whereas Word is geared towards Western languages in the first place, but it's hard. You know, I might be the wrong person to ask that question, because I don't do those crazy PowerPoints either, man. I just list out the information.
Well, I remember another situation with AM2 where we were very eager to see some movement on Virtua Fighter. And what was really popular at the time was the Mortal Kombat series, which were going very deep into lore for the single-player game.
Yeah.
So those were like movies with scenes where you could interact and fight. And it was a pretty neat way to establish the different characters and their relationships. And we thought that that is something that would be great for Virtua Fighter, because there is very little known about the actual characters and their relationships. And so I went to Japan and I pitched that to AM2, and they effectively told us, why are you wasting our time telling us what kind of Virtua Fighter game to make? What we want from you is effectively approval to move forward with a Virtua Fighter game with a P&L. And that is what will give us the feeling like it's worth listening or talking to you. We need to know that you have a marketing budget set aside for this. Then we'll move forward. But don't tell us how to make our game. And just clear the way for us globally to have the resources to get it made. And that's how it should be done.
Commit to selling all these units and then we'll make the game.
Yes.
That's right. So know your role, right? One thing, this is an aside, but Virtua Fighter never had much of a story to begin with. You know, Sega has always sucked about creating characters and stories and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they have very few, you know, Yakuza and Sonic are about it. That might be just an AM2 thing. You know, AM2 is a very proud group, and they have a long history, you know, with Yu-san, obviously Yu Suzuki, when he was with them. AM3, we were different, man. Our biggest successes were Crazy Taxi and Virtua Tennis. And those were my two bosses, the people who made those. And
was that Kano-san? Is that right?
Yeah, Kano-san was my direct boss. He's the guy I learned learned everything to do and what not to do about being a producer of video games in Japan. And that's a whole story.
Well, I love that. I love that guy, because when we were doing the Crazy Taxi mobile game, he came to our offices and worked with us and tried to make clear what the soul of that series was, and was very, very concerned and focused on making sure that it would be great. And we put Hulk Hogan in that game, I remember. There were all sorts of crazy things we were able to do, and we had those resources because Kano-san believed in us and in the project.
That was a good game.
He's always had a big international focus, as Kumagai-san, who made Virtua Tennis, she does too, and there are other games as well. For an arcade division, they were very open to ideas and feedback from the West. So I think I was fortunate in that respect. Maybe that's one of the reasons they hired me.
And no surprise, you know, they had two crossover hits from arcades into to Dreamcast. So
exactly.
Speaks to the power of having that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so Crazy Taxi in particular, that basically is set in San Francisco.
Right.
They don't say it out loud, but that is clear. So that is also a bit surprising to me, because in the console world, it was often very hard to convince some of those teams, including the Yakuza team, to set things in America. So when we worked on Binary Domain, our big ask, which was a cover shooter, was to set it in the West, even if it was a destroyed West, like post-apocalyptic, just make it in the West. But they insisted on setting it in Tokyo. They would not budge on that. And yet Crazy Taxi, again, is like, it just feels so Western. And it was a global hit. It was hugely popular in arcades in Japan, as I understand it.
Yeah, it was popular. You know, a part of that is the time that both Crazy Taxi and, for example, Sonic Adventure were developed. There was a time, you know, right before the Dreamcast was coming, Sonic Team actually moved to San Francisco.
Yep.
They were right there in our offices. Got to know several of them pretty well. And Kano-san had been out to San Francisco several times, and they were totally pumped about being in San Francisco. They loved it, and they really kind of soaked it in. And I think you saw that in those series, right?
Series.
Yeah, thank you. I forget English.
It's allowed. It's allowed.
It is. Later, you know, after the Dreamcast kind of went the way it did, Sega got a lot more conservative, and they probably, I don't know, maybe that got reflected in the games in Binary Domain.
Okay. So working in Japanese offices, especially in game development, it is very different than in the US. Like, there are rules like you don't leave before the boss leaves, stuff like that. Is it still that way? This is something I'm reflecting on from like a decade past.
I suppose in certain companies there are. Traditionally, that has always been the thing. You work until the boss is done and that sort of thing. When I was at Sega, I was like the first one to leave. I was like, screw that, you know. And a lot of people, we didn't have that kind of culture where, you know, we waited for Kano-san to leave. No, do your work, and once it's done, you go. So he was good about fostering that kind of culture. I've heard horror stories, like Sonic Team, one of the guys there, he was like, yeah, you know, I got a sleeping bag under my desk, you know.
Yeah,
it depends on the circumstance.
Well, even here in the US, I just remember Sonic Team being there all the time. All the time.
They were, man. They were. Yeah, like, it was no matter night or day, you'd see someone from Sonic Team wandering the halls.
If somebody would want to take the same journey that you did and go from working in the West to working in Japan,
yeah,
what would be the biggest culture shocks, and what would be actually better?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're going to get a much more rigid structure, as far as there are more rules, there are more, you know, social norms that you have. I mean, for example, I remember at SOJ, we all took a class, even the Japanese people, it wasn't just me, took a class about proper etiquette when having guests from other companies or what have you come to the office. And for example, they give you a layout of a door or a room, a meeting room, right? And here's the door, here's the table, here are the chairs. Where does the most, for the client side, the most, the word is edai in Japanese, is the top, on the leader or the structure, where does the boss sit in that case? Well, they sit at the seat facing the door, the farthest away from it. And there are rules like that. Ah. And so then it goes down to, down the ranks, so your lowest person would be at the door or the seat closest to the door. The hosts are always back to the door. The guests are always facing the door. Now, what happens if you have a round table? Then you have to do it so that you kind of have to mentally measure so that the head of the guest side gets the farthest seat from the door. Things like that, these kind of cultural / business cultural things that you definitely have to learn. And I found there's a lot more paperwork involved. Well, that might just be because I became a producer, though, so it's hard to say, but there is a lot of paperwork. It still is in my line of business. Good things are, it's still game development. It's not radically different from the West, I don't think. And my experience was you see an attention to detail for sure.
Yeah.
It's always been a hallmark of Japanese games. I mean, people are there to really, mold things and really like tweak them until they're just like as perfect as they could be. And that kind of work ethic is definitely interesting to see.
Well, one thing that I was always happily surprised by was when we would work on, say, an update or a reimagining of a game that was all the way from the Genesis era, we would be talking to people who actually worked on that original game because people stayed forever. It seems like job security is something that is very different there than here. Whereas here, I remember a time when Activision was talking about record profits and on the same day announced massive layoffs.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like it's the same thing in Japan. It seems like if you find your culture and your place and you work hard, you'll be able to stay there pretty much forever.
Yeah, that still exists. It's changing slowly, but for a Japanese company, if you hire someone as a full-time employee, it's hard to fire them unless there are huge circumstances that warrant it. So when I left SOJ in, what was it, 2008, something like that, Sega was kind of struggling at the time. So for their full-time employees, they had a voluntary leave or voluntary, you could choose to quit. They'd give you a severance package and you could go. They wouldn't fire you. A lot of people took them up on that. So there was a big change there at SOJ. A lot of people left at the same time I did. I was a contractor, so I didn't get that old benefits package or whatever. We all left and we were all like, what do we do now? Let's all form our own companies and help each other out. So there's a big network of former SOJ people that we all kind of work together and help each other with projects and whatnot. So that's pretty cool. When I was at Sega.com back in San Francisco, we had a round of layoffs and I got hit just out of nowhere. I didn't expect it at all. And it was a very different experience than what I saw happening at SOJ. And I think that getting laid off all of a sudden from a job that I absolutely loved, working with people that I absolutely loved, is that was kind of the wake-up call to me where, like, if I don't get some additional skills, in my tool chest or what have you, have some additional tools, then this could happen again. And that's kind of why I decided to learn Japanese. One of the reasons.
How hard was it to acclimate just to the basics of living in Japan? I went for 2 weeks and I was trying to order food. And I remember I just got a huge block of tofu because I didn't know what I was asking for. So, I had to learn how to get by on public transportation, which was enormously confusing to me. How was it the first several months?
Yeah, so the block of tofu thing, that's like a joke that Japanese play on foreigners.
Is it really?
No, I'm sorry. Oh. No. New guy, let's give him a block of tofu. No, it's very, very, very difficult. And what I found is like being a little kid again, like almost a baby, like a toddler. You start from toddler level. You can't order for yourself. You can't take care of yourself hardly at all. And I had to lean on my school in my language school there, and a couple of friends I had there. I chose the Sendai, which is up in the north of Japan, because it's close to where I have a really good friend of mine, where his family is. So I had to lean on them a bit until I learned enough of the language. And what I found is after about 3 months, I could understand what people were saying to me. I couldn't respond. After about 6 months, words started coming out. After about a year, I started feeling pretty comfortable conversationally. Still couldn't read that great, but I was working on it. And after 2 years, I was able to pass the level one of the Japanese language proficiency test. And so it took 2 years to really be able to function like an adult, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard. My advice to anyone listening to this who thinks, oh, I'm good at languages, because I thought I was, you know, in college, I spent 6 months in Italy on a study abroad program. And I by the end of it, I was chirping Italian. I was like, man, I'm good at languages. No, it's Japanese is a whole nother thing, you know? So, yeah,
well,
it's hard. You got to want it.
So Chris and I worked with a guy named Rob who was fluent in Japanese, but I didn't know that at all until there was one meeting where he randomly started talking Japanese. And I asked him afterwards, I'm like, you've had so many opportunities to use that and haven't. Why? And he's like, well, I was in a room where I trusted people, and so I felt comfortable, and it made the conversation more comfortable to move to Japanese. But he said, for a lot of people, once they know that you speak Japanese, they treat you differently. They don't see you as a naive or innocent gaijin, and there's a lot more expectations that you're best off avoiding.
You could play that game if you want. There are times, for example, you may have heard of NHK, which is the national broadcasting thing here, and it's just like the BBC where you have to pay a license fee to them. And they'll come, if you don't pay, they'll come door to door asking for money. Now, they can't legally take money from you. So when they come to my door, then I become really foreign. I forget all of my Japanese all of a sudden, you know. So there are times and places where that works, yeah.
So AM3, what projects did you work on there?
So my main project was one called Dinosaur King, which is
I remember that.
Yeah, it was a game. Well, there was a game called Mushi King, which is, you know, insects, and you take cards and scan them, and it's basically a rock, paper, scissors type game with a little more depth than that. But it was a huge hit in Japan. And so what Kano-san decided to do is, let's make a version that might do well in the West. Let's use dinosaurs. And I was brought on to be the co-producer on that. So we worked on the arcade version, worked on the localized version of the arcade game, and then we did a DS version as well, which was farmed out to a group that is no longer with us, but they're called Climax. They did Land Stalker, Dark Savior, those kind of games in the past, Shining in the Darkness, for all you old heads listening.
Yep.
That's and they did the DS version for us, which was a straight RPG with, you know, kid-friendly RPG with dinosaur bone excavation, because it was the DS, so you had to use that touchscreen somehow. And anytime, I've made several dinosaur like games since then, like apps and whatnot. And every time that everyone thinks, oh, it'd be so much fun to just, you can have these fossils and you brush them with your finger, with your stylus, and it ends up not being fun at all. So it just, the first time, okay, cool, but then it just starts wearing on you. So little bit of advice for those making dinosaur games out there.
Well, so what I'd love to know about the experience of working on arcade games is, what is the length of development cycle, or what was it back then? And then when you launch, you probably go to some test markets, right? Maybe one or two arcades in Akihabara, get feedback, understand how to scale it out. And you were talking about make it global. So does it ultimately end up going to GameWorks or Dave & Buster's in the U.S.? How is all of this rolled out? How do you get the information you need to know how big to go?
So the ones I worked on were already kind of established series. So the development was already in motion, and a lot of the arcade games do tend to be kind of series that get updated. But it's just like you say, say we're gonna make this game, we make it, but before it's finished, you take it to an arcade or two. It's called location test, and you do a location test in like Akihabara or Ikebukuro or places like that, and you actually sit there and watch the people play and just gauge their reactions. you might interview them afterwards, you know, see, hey, you know, how'd you like the game? You do definitely look at the revenue, you know, you want to see, because you're not, these aren't like, you know, paid testers. These aren't, they're just your average people off the street. And then you take the feedback from the location test and you tweak your game, and then you get it ready to go. But, it, you know, it's not just software, right? There's a whole division at SOJ called Mechatoro, which stands for, I guess, like mechanical technology or something like that. Mm. And that's where they build the cabinets. So you've got, and that's fun, man, if you ever have a chance to go there, because it's like a its own world, man, because you see all these crazy cabinets, especially the ones that, you know, the big attraction cabinets that get made for places like Dave and Buster's. You get to see how these things are made, and all these mechanical things going on all around you. You feel like you're, you know, James Bond in Q's laboratory. You know, there's just all this kind of crazy stuff going on, and you have to work with them to get your cabinet made, right? And they'll tell you, you know, you got to work out the costs for the cabinets. You know, obviously it's not cheap to make a big Daytona USA four-seater,
right?
You know, and it's not just making it, shipping it is the other thing too, you know. And that's why I think Sega was out in near Haneda for so long, because it's just easier to ship things out there in the boonies than it is being based in the heart of Tokyo. And then localization, it really comes down to working with the arcade group in America, seeing what they want, seeing if, okay, we got this game, what do you think? Now, when Chris and I were at Sega.com, we were right near the arcade division. They're just salespeople, basically, sales and distributor type. But they would always have the new arcade games in, which was really cool. You know, we got to see all these cool games before that, you know, Planet Harriers, Wild Riders, Typing of the Dead. That was the first time I saw Typing of the Dead. And man, let me tell you, the best Typing of the Dead players were the secretaries. Man, they would come in, there was, I forget her name. She would come in and play, oh, and she would destroy everybody in Typing of the Dead. Anyway, that's an aside. But so yeah, if America determines that they want the game, then you begin the localization process, and that's what we did with Dinosaur King. Dinosaur King was more, I mean, we got some units in America, but also Southeast Asia as well. We did a Chinese version too. Yeah.
Okay.
And we did voices and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Well, arcade is such a fascinating thing to me in the West, because of course you had the explosion in the early 80s with, you know, Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and all of that. And then it went a little bit quiet, and then it had a resurgence with Street Fighter II. And that came out when I was in high school, and then Mortal Kombat after that. And so every bowling alley, every Denny's had their own machines, right? 7-Eleven always had a machine. And then we moved ultimately to a window where, yes, you got your Dave and Buster's, you got your GameWorks, but it was kind of the beginning of the end. And it's so strange to me now to see something like a brand new Tekken or a brand new Street Fighter, and it only comes out as a console game now. Same teams in many cases, but are you kidding me that something like Street Fighter VI can't have a single arcade cabinet in the Bay Area? That it's just, there's no audience for it? Because it's not like with film, which has had its ups and downs, that theaters just disappeared. But that's kind of what happened with arcades. And so now, yes, if you go to a movie theater, ironically, you will find some Raw Thrills cabinets and stuff, but those are often 10 years old. And there's no scene for brand new games to pop and be a thing. That culture has just died. And I know that even in Japan, Akihabara, there are some big arcades that have closed.
Yeah.
I believe Sega has sold off their arcade business either primarily or entirely out there. What has the death of arcade looked like from the Japanese side? Because it lasted a lot longer than it did out here.
Yeah, it's just like you said, it took longer, but it's pretty much here now. Arcades still exist. The majority of the machines in there are going to be your crane games, your UFO catchers, your, to a lesser extent, the photo booth things. Then you go up to the metal games, or the metal, M-E-D-A-L, the ones where you play with the metals. And they're kind of like, you'll see slot machine type things, but a lot of it's just kind of crane or coin pusher type stuff, and people get these medals, and you know, which are not real money. You can't do anything with them but play the game and hope you get more medals so you can play more, you know. That's the vast majority of what's making up arcades right now. And it's sad to see, of course. I mean, we've all put our tokens up or quarters up on, you know, to get next, and or had the roll of tokens and whatnot. But yeah, those days are gone, and they're finally gone in Japan.
Are they gone? Gone? Like you can't play there? There's got to be arcade machines there still, yeah.
There are. Okay. There are.
It's just not as robust a scene as it used to be.
Yeah, most arcades will have a corner that have traditional video games, and a lot of them are fighting games or music games. That's the other one I forgot. A lot of rhythm games, you know, where you, because you
Hatsune
want the
Miku.
Device. Yeah, you, there's that. There's the Taiko no Tatsujin, which is the drum, you know, Taiko drum thing. There's the guitars and the drums and all that. And those you can't really reproduce at home. And so they still have a market. But yeah, you know, it's not like it used to be where, you know, a new game would come out in the arcade first and then get ported.
So how has that affected, to the degree that you know, the people working on arcade games? Is there still a fully staffed AM2 and AM3? Are they being focused more on console or mobile experiences? What's happening with all of those groups?
A lot of my old AM3 crew, they went to mobile, you know, and a lot of them have gone to console and mobile. There's still arcade groups, and but yeah, a lot of them get focused more on the mechanical side of things, you know, UFO catchers and what have you. And yeah, so it's different, and that's kind of, I think, one of the big reasons why Sega was able to move to more to the heart of Tokyo and Osaka, because they don't have to be out in a place where it's easy to ship out giant cabinets and what. So,
well, and it's interesting looking at it from Sega's perspective specifically, because back when Genesis came out, the biggest competitive advantage it had over the NES was that you could play authentic arcade experiences at home. The pack-in was Altered Beast. Golden Axe was a big deal.
Yeah, and it did what Nintendo don't, right?
Yep.
Oh, it blew me away. That's where I really, Sega became my favorite game company, is when I was at a friend's, and he was able to get the Genesis before I could scrape together enough you know, lawn mowing money to get it. And he had Ghouls, and it was Altered Beast, of course, and then Ghouls and Ghosts. And once I saw Ghouls and Ghosts, even though it's a Capcom game, I was just like, oh my god, this is it, you know, this is the thing. And so then I eventually got the Genesis. I was kind of a Sega guy ever since.
What was interesting back then was Ghouls and Ghosts, Strider, those were arcade games made by Capcom, but it was actually Sega developers who got the license and made it a console version. And they were so good at that. Both of those games were fantastic at home.
Definitely. Yeah, I loved them. Yeah, I mean, I can't say enough about the Genesis, the Mega Drive. Sega was, you know, firing on all cylinders then. But it didn't do well in Japan, unfortunately, so.
Yeah, well, Saturn was actually, ironically, the one that did better in Japan than it did here, and part of that has to have been Virtua Fighter, because Virtua Fighter 1 and then Virtua Fighter 2 looked astonishing on that console hardware. It was so good.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Saturn did well here. It fought with PlayStation quite well, valiantly, I'd say. You know, it had its own niche, you know, the Sega fans, the arcade fans. And then also, they had lots of those typical, you know, romance, visual novel type things that the market here loves, too. So,
well, I want to ask about that, too, because there's one visual novel that I played that I fell in love with, which was called Steins Gate. And I still think that as a time travel story, it's up there with Back to the Future in terms of, like, just really capturing your attention. It's fantastic. But there was a year or two where that kind of game became hugely popular in Japan, wasn't it?
Oh, that's like, you know, every year since video games have, you know, since the dawn of history, basically, visual novel thing here is so huge. And it's not just consoles. PC games are dominated by them here. The visual novels have been big since, yeah, forever, especially once, you know, CD-ROMs came out. then you could put the voice in and really kind of create the full multimedia experience, right? So
yeah, well, and storytelling, I mean, some of those were really just well written, really cool to see that explode, and I wish that that happened out here. One thing that is finally coming into popularity in the US that has been mega popular for a long time in Japan is Monster Hunter.
Yeah.
And I just remember going to visit Japan and going to Yodobashi Camera and seeing in the parks complete strangers grouping up together to play that game. And I just thought that was the coolest social phenomenon to see, because it wasn't people connecting online. It was all local Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
Yesterday, I was going to a cafe for breakfast. They weren't open yet. This is near Skytree. I was waiting, and then there's this big group of dudes, like older dudes, late 50s, early 60s, and they all had their phones out, and they were all together. They were like this. It was like, oh, they're catching Pokemon, aren't they? And then after that, when the cafe opened, they all went in, and they're all talking. They're all friends. I think they all bonded over the Pokemon. They started having beers and all this kind of stuff, you know, your 9 a.m. beers. And yeah, so that kind of phenomenon definitely is a thing. And yeah, Monster Hunter was one of those games that really helped make that happen.
You saying that kind of just reminds me of how video games is so much more ingrained in Japanese culture than it is in the U.S. I think the U.S. is becoming more so that way. And in many ways, I always see Japan as living a little bit in the future in terms of trends and when I first went to Japan, just being astounded at the cell phones, the technology, and this is back before the iPhone, of course. Even in the salad days of the arcade, it was a all ages affair. You had kids there, you had families there, and there's really nothing like that here in terms of like a video gaming mass experience. It's always been pretty siloed. So when I was in high school, you go to the arcade and it was all, you know, punks like me sitting there scrounging quarters.
That's
pretty
right.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's they've always had a very positive outlook when it came to video games. They saw it as entertainment, of course, but I think a lot of people here, they don't see it as like, oh, it's going to rot your brain and all that kind of stuff. Because obviously, if you're sitting there playing a game and it's problem solving and whatnot, then there's good there. Yeah, now what's funny is, like you said, it used to be kind of like an all-ages affair. And then I recently found an arcade near, like an old arcade. They have all the old games and stuff. And they do it old school where, like, people can smoke in there and stuff. And I brought my kids there. They couldn't handle it. I was like, sons, this is culture. This is your culture. You need to be learning this, because when I was young, when I was your age, I didn't care about the cigarette smoke smell. We rode in... you know, you could smoke in airplanes, and they were like, what? You know, so yeah, just different times, right?
I didn't wear a helmet when I rode my bike.
That's right. Or yeah, I never wore a seatbelt. That's kind of a culture I miss. I think most people, especially those who have worked on the arcade side, we all kind of miss that. I was out having dinner with the guy who made, it's called a world championship football. It's the soccer game with the cards. Have you seen that one?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He left Sega at the same time I did, and he has so many stories. He's probably the best podcast guest you could ever have, but because he was old. I mean, he was there since the 80s. But yeah, we miss those arcade games big time. And the funny thing about that game is, it's one he always wanted to make, but the Sega heads were always against it. They're like, no, this will never sell. It'll never do well. And this is kind of the story of if you want to have a successful game as a director or producer at Sega, you pretty much have to go and make it yourself. And that would happen a lot back in the day. Now, I'm sure it doesn't happen at all. But you kind of at least make a prototype, you know, just get people together after hours, say, hey, man, let's make this. And that's what they would do. And a lot of those old school Sega games were made in that way.
Interesting.
Well, kind of the legend of Mega Man was that was a Skunkworks project on a small teams like After Hours. They had a lot of focus on making a great action platform game that was not being asked for. And they had so much desire to make it that they did it on their own, and it ended up being a big hit.
Since you have a unique Western gaming perspective and a Japanese gaming perspective, what was more fun, E3 back in the day or TGS back in the day?
You know, I got to say E3, because back in the day, that was at least when I was there, it was the Dreamcast days, and you know, Sega went big.
They did go large.
You know, just the giant booths. We had the girl dressed up like Ooh La La, and just you know, just all sorts of stuff. Whereas Tokyo Game Show is I mean, it's good, it's interesting, but I think part of it, once you get older, the sheen kind of wears off, and you see it just as a business kind of thing now.
I will say that one of the weirdest things going to TGS for me was seeing like the Sega booth with Need for Speed in it, where you have a lot of games that are popular in the West being distributed through Japanese developers out there or publishers. And that was kind of a shock.
There's a niche here for Western games for sure, whether it be sports, racing. FPS is on the rise of late, which historically FPS has not been popular here at all. Partly because I was told this, and I've seen it actually, is that a lot of people here get sick on the 3D.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that's over, you know, a generation or so. That's kind of, you know, when, like my kids, they can play 3D games. They could play 3D games when they were three, you know. So, but then the other thing is there's no gun culture here, which is kind of nice.
Yes.
But FPSs are on the rise.
PC gaming's on the rise, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, so HD gaming in general, you look at PlayStation right now, and the PlayStation 5 feels very much like it's made for Westerners, not for Japanese players. Yet the Switch, it seems like all of the big hits in Japan that chart for console are all on Nintendo's platform. Is that just because people don't want big HD games on a 70-inch screen, or what is motivating that?
I think it goes back to what we were talking about, where people want to play what they know. And if you buy a Mario game, you know you're going to get Mario. If you buy a Pokemon game, you know you're going to get the Pokemon experience. I think that's what it is. Whereas the Sony, especially with their internal studios, they're trying new things. And games like God of War and Last of Us, you see them on the shelves here. They sell to a degree. But
yeah,
if you ask your average Japanese gamer what they want to play, they'd rather play a Monster Hunter or a Pokemon or something that they know. It's just how it is here, generally.
That's interesting. Well, so I have a son who's 14. And he loves being an otaku. He loves Yu-Gi-Oh! We'll play that instead of Magic the Gathering. He carries around a Game Boy Advance, and even though he has an iPhone, he doesn't want to play games on that. He wants to play it on the Game Boy so that they can be cool Japanese games. You know, he loves Naruto and other anime. So are there people in Japan who are similar but flipped from a Western perspective? So people who just, like, they want to get that Xbox. They love Western movies. Is there that kind of person out there, or is that just, you know, not something that exists?
It's hard to say with games, because those people don't really come out into the daylight, I don't think. But, you know, for sure, one thing that's interesting about Japanese culture is people, if they have a hobby, they tend to really get into it. One example, when I was playing in bands, there was this one band that was an Allman Brothers cover band.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't just play the songs. They all dressed just like the Allman Brothers. They played every lick, every note to, you know, the nth degree of perfection. And that was their thing. Like, we love this. This is what we love to do. Another story like this, when I was in Sendai, I would ride my bike around, just a little exercise, but they had a river there. I would ride by it. And every weekend, I would see this older gentleman flying an RC plane around in big circles in the sky. Big circles. He was there every weekend for hours, flying that plane in circles. And I'm like, when are enough circles enough, right? But then I'm out there riding my bike each weekend, so who am I to talk?
Yeah, know? Yeah.
Yeah, so you do see a dedication. So I'm sure there's a group of people who are super into military, you know, Call of Duty type things. And that's probably their thing. And they probably sit there in their living room dressed up in camo and play.
Well, something I've seen in Japan, just enough to ask about it, is passed out businessmen late at night. What's going on there?
There's a couple things. One being, it's a very it's a drinking culture here. There's no stigma attached to getting drunk. You can convenience stores sell alcohol 24 hours a day. there's really no barriers to it. But then, especially the old traditional businessmen, after work, you go out and you all go out drinking, right? Well, if you hadn't eaten all day, or and the way they drink sometimes, they'll pound it down, you know, stress relief, instant stress relief. Well, that can also, you know, that can come to bite you. And then another thing here is it's the, what do they call it, the Asian flush or whatever, where there's a certain enzyme a lot of people don't have here to break down the alcohol as efficiently as other, you know, types. And so you'll see people get very red and then pass out.
Ah.
And, yeah. And then you'll also see, I mean, you walk in home and you see people, you know, thrown up on the streets and whatnot. It's just, nobody likes it, but it's just kind of part of the Tokyo experience anyway.
Well, and it seems like it's safer to have that happen to you in Japan than it would be out here. It's people just kind of leave people alone, which is interesting. I heard that the quote unquote bad part of town in Japan was Roppongi, which still is like way safer and cleaner than, you know, the safest parts of the Bay Area, it seems to me.
There's no dangerous part of Japan. There really isn't. You'd have to work at it to put yourself in trouble here.
You probably have to speak Japanese to get into the, you know, to get yourself in that much trouble.
That would be one thing.
Yeah, I mean, people will drink until they barf here, especially, you know, in San Francisco. So, you know, Friday, Saturday night, you see some people that are definitely tied one on a little too much. But some things are so fascinating to me about Japan. The, you know, Nomi Hodai, which is all you can drink. They just don't have that here because Americans would completely just abuse it, first of all, and abuse their livers to death. So, and the types of restaurants on offer. So cooking food at your own table, having this big vat of boiling oil sitting right in front of you, that would just never happen in an American restaurant. You just get teenagers that would roll in and shove napkins into all of them and then walk out kind of thing. So
it's true.
It makes Japan a pretty special place in a lot of ways, just because of the culture that's there, and people are polite, and it's a safe place to walk around at night. Yeah, for sure, it's got its issues, but it's a pretty awesome place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something I fell in love with, the level of civility here, and the people. Yeah, people generally leave you alone, and then things like you mentioned, all you can drink at a restaurant or a bar, 2 hours, all you can drink. It's just something that wouldn't fly in America because people would take advantage of it or do stupid stuff, whereas, you know, here they don't.
I think just from a legal liability standpoint, I think it wouldn't fly here.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and people don't get violent here either. That's another thing. Like, even if they get drunk, I mean, on occasion you'll see people like yelling at each other or whatnot. But the only time I ever saw any sort of violence, this was back in Sendai at a karaoke place. Me and some friends were coming out of it, and in the lobby there were like four dudes on each side, and they were yelling at each other. And one would kind of step forward, you know, and then he kind of go back, and you know, you knew nothing was really going to happen. But then all of a sudden, one guy picked up like this trash can, like a steel, like, or more like an ashtray, you know, one of those standing ashtray things, and he threw it at the other side. I was like, man, it's some WWF stuff here, or E now. But and then once that got thrown, then there was more yelling, but then we left. But I don't think anything happened. But the funny thing was the staff working there, they just had their heads down like this. They weren't getting involved. They weren't doing anything.
Interesting.
Well, so that sounds like something ripped right out of a Yakuza game.
Oh, totally.
That's where I have to ask, do you ever see people in snakeskin boots missing a finger with colorful suits? Is that a thing?
If you go to certain areas of Shinjuku, you can see the colorful suits and the snakeskin shoes. You don't really see Yakuza that much. You'll see them. Well, you'll see certain cars with very dark tinted windows that, you know, okay, that's probably, you know, there's some Yakuza in there. And then when you go to the beach, and sometimes sauna type places as well, but definitely the beach, you'll see people with the full back tats and whatnot. And they're just normal people at that point. You know, they're nice, they're friendly. They don't mess with anybody. It's not like Yakuza, you know, the game where they'll just come up to you like, and then they'll want to start fighting, you know? yeah. So on occasion, yes. But it's not like the game.
Okay, so civilians don't have to, like, go to the other side of the street or something. It's
No, the Yakuza stay out of people's way. They prefer to operate underground for obvious reasons.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, it's a, you know, the thing that really struck me when I was out there was something as simple as seeing a bike rack and no one was locking up their bikes. And there was not litter all over the place either. It was like the streets were like Disneyland clean. It was really striking to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's not everywhere. You can find trash on the ground if you look for it, but it's compared to other major cities, especially ones the size of Tokyo, it's amazingly clean, and there's not a lot wrong with it, to be honest. It's pretty damn good.
So it's great that everyone works together to keep, you know, the culture vibrant and people safe. But in the U.S., obviously, there's this huge focus on individualism and being a unique voice and trying to be the person that stands out. You know, I know that there are some people in Japan like that, right? Like the head of the Yakuza team for such a long time.
Negoshi-san?
Negoshi-san. Yeah, like he was super tan and wore, like, clothes that made him stand out. Even Izuka-san, like, would dress, like, in a very distinct, colorful way that would make him stand out. But it seems like most people were dressed exactly like everyone else, that there was less of a focus on individualism.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. It's, as you say, America, to its detriment at times, is very individualistic. That's why you get TikTokers doing all this I'm the main character crap, you know, and disrupting people's lives. Whereas Japan is quite the opposite. People don't want to tend to stick out. Now, Negoshi-san's a special case in that I remember going to executive meetings trying to get money for Dinosaur King and whatnot. And you'd be in there, big table, and it'd be old guy in suit, old guy in suit, old guy in suit. Negoshi-san in a jumpsuit. old guy in suit, old guy in suit. And you could see Negoshi-san walking down the street from a mile away, man, because the guy's bright white jumpsuit, dark skin. And I just happen to have, this is from the, you know, I know your podcast is audio only, but I'll show you. Super Monkey Ball, when it came out on GameCube, that's a signed.
Oh, copy. Nice.
Lovely.
This is what he used to look like.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Man. The trading card.
When you remember these trading cards? The E3 trading cards? Yeah, I have the full set, actually. So when I first met him, he was like this. He had long hair. He's just a nice, normal dude. And we talked about, I interviewed him for the website and talked about Monkey Ball. He's a real nice guy. Apparently what happened, he went through like a difficult divorce, I believe it was. And then he started going to those, they call them kabakuros, cabaret clubs, a hostess clubs in Shinjuku, and started getting really into that. And I think he met some Yakuza people and started method acting to a degree. And he started wearing the jumpsuits, cut his hair, got dark, went to the tanning booth. And then he made the game that kind of almost saved Sega. He was on the Shenmue team. And you can see, so Shenmue is a big, costly failure.
Definitely see the influence.
The DNA
sure.
is there. And I think Shenmue begat the Yakuza series.
Though I was always told to be very careful not to compare Shenmue to Yakuza because apparently the relationship with Yu-san and Negoshi-san was complicated, and so those comparisons were not welcome when talking to the Yakuza team.
A lot of people who are on the Shenmue team have nothing nice to say about the experience at all. Many of them hated it. And Yu-san's super nice. He's super mellow, but apparently it was just a draconian situation. And it was just a slog for years. And pretty much, I could see why the relationship would be strained. A lot of people, you know, for example, that the WCCF producer and Yu-san get along great. And he was part of the Shenmue team as well. He told me, yeah, man, it was just awful. Awful, awful. The worst experience of my life kind of thing. So, yeah. Not
character building.
It was so interesting when that game came out. That came out before I was at Sega, Shenmue.
Okay.
I was pushing to give Shenmue, because I was an editorial at the time, an A+. And the reason was that I felt like it reached for the brass ring in a way that no other game had before.
For sure.
And even some of the decisions that frustrated players was to the benefit of storytelling. So an example was almost no one dies in the Shenmue games, but when someone does, it's a big deal because that is what real life is like. You have to go to work and you have to take time to drive a forklift and put things into place, which is boring, but so is real life. And so when you're finally in a position where someone dies or there's a fight or something spikes the energy level in the game, it's super impactful in a way that you just can't achieve if people are dying 10 at a time every 3 minutes. And I really admired that restraint.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like you said, it kind of got the day-to-day life. I mean, I know on a day-to-day basis, I go looking for sailors all the time. And I do gachapon type stuff all the time. No, but I know what you're saying. I kid, but it was definitely it was its own thing, man. And I enjoyed it for what it was. And when Shenmue 2 came out, then it became more like a game instead of a big tech demo. And I thought that was great.
Well, the Hauser brothers were outspoken from the Rockstar saying that Shenmue was a great inspiration for them for Grand Theft Auto. And it really is proto Grand Theft Auto, if you look at it.
Yeah, it was extremely influential for sure. And it just cost way too much money and it failed big time. Unfortunately, but it definitely inspired so many games to follow it that you got to call it a success based off of that.
Well, imagine you were saying how traditional development cycles, people just iterate on the things that they know work. Mm-hmm. And one thing I have always admired about Sega's ethos has been that they don't do that, that they actually try new things.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what it would have been like to be Yusan taking that kind of swing with that kind of budget to make a game like Shenmue, which had no precedence, nothing like it had been made before? What a huge risk. And it's not just that game. It's like you look at anything from Seaman to Samba de Amigo to Jet Grind Radio to all these crazy experiments that had no precedent to say this would work. And they were greenlit at Japan and people were able to do them. But what a huge risk. And if there are people who are in that culture very risk averse, that must have been kind of scary in many cases for the artists to do their thing.
Yeah, it was peak Sega, that era, for sure, as far as taking risks. But in the case of Yusan, he earned it because, I mean, he, you know, whether it be Hang On, Outrun, Virtual Fighter, he had hit after hit, Space Harrier.
Yeah.
He had to cash it to say, look, I want to make this kind of game. And they were like, okay, cool, go for it. It is, like you said, especially Dreamcast era when they splintered off it, you know, or took all the arcade groups and made them into separate studios. There were so many innovative games that came out of that, whether it be Jet Set Radio, Rez. Skies of Arcadia was great for JRPG, just so awesome. And there are just so many good games. Virtua Tennis, I mean, came out of nowhere. Really, and Crazy Taxi as well. AM3 was Hitmaker.
Yeah.
And Hitmaker was one of, I think, two studios that actually made money. Thinking the other one was probably AM1, were they Amusement Vision or something? The rest of them lost money, sadly.
Well, and then you look at today, Atlus, right, which Sega owns. Metaphor ReFantazio is going to be at the top of a lot of people's list for Game of the Year, and I think it's going to be the winner in many cases. But that game had an 8-year development cycle.
Wow. Phew, I wouldn't want to be on that team.
Yeah, but that's not an unusual thing, it seems. I know the Persona games take forever to get released. What can you tell us about that? You know, these games that it appears they have endless time to get it right.
It's got to be an Atlus thing.
Well, it's kind of the Naughty Dog factor,
yeah.
Right? It's done when it's done. They've built the swagger, built the reputation that let them do their thing and they'll deliver.
Yeah, and Atlus has always been its own thing. You know, Atlus, I had a friend who worked at Atlus for a while and she said that, man, the offices are just like you'd imagine, you know, it would be if you look at their games. It's like everything's dark and they got weird characters all over the place. And I mean, they're just, they got their own twist to them. I can't, most companies you can't just get, here you go, take an 8-year cycle and do it until it's right. I think you do have to build that backlog and be able to say, okay, yeah, we can deliver. I mean, you know, a company like From Software, you can do that. Maybe Atlus too, but, you know, a company like Sega probably couldn't sit there and make something for 8 years. You know?
Right, right. Well, so how much did the mobile space change gaming in Japan? Because I remember like Puzzle and Dragon was just monolithic and everyone was playing that. And it seemed for a while when Chris and I were at Sega that there was just less and less interest or attention being paid to console and PC because mobile became so huge.
It changed everything, really. It was a time where, it was you were either playing on handhelds or at arcades or on consoles, and that was it. Then when mobile came out and provided, it really took the casual side of things. For a while, it took some core players, too, but then, now it's very much your casual gaming device is going to be your phone. And that's a huge market, and that's a market that generates lots of revenue. And here in mobile, in Japan, it's not a car culture, at least here in Tokyo. So, people are on the trains, you have time, sit there, and you're going to, you can sit there and play a couple of rounds of a puzzle game like Puzzle and Dragons, and it just works for the culture here.
Well, an all portrait, not landscape. People want to do it with one hand, right? And I'm assuming that's the transit systems.
That's changed a bit. But yeah, I remember when we were making some games and just kind of talking to people. And a lot of the people I talked to, just your average user, they would say they don't want to do it in landscape because it would be obvious that they're playing a game.
Oh, interesting.
In portrait, you could just, you just look like you're curing cancer or whatever. That's probably changed. At least young people, they don't care. They're just doing it landscape anyway. But your older set, they didn't want to look like they're playing lowly mobile games.
So how do you move up in Japanese companies? Like how does a Negoshi-san go from being the kind of meek looking guy that you were showing us a picture of to suddenly a director who's running all of games at Sega? Like, and are people generally in a position where they have that ambition that they just want to move up the ladder, or are they happy to find where they are and just stay there? Because there's the pressure expectation in the West that everyone is supposed to try to move into a manager position and hopefully a director, and the very few get lucky enough to be a VP or a CEO. Like, is that the desired path out there?
No. And by the way, Negoshi-san's an extreme case, but it is salient to what I'm about to say. If you wanted to stay a 3D designer your entire career, 3D modeler your entire career, you could do that. You could just tell them, I just want to do 3D modeling. I don't want to manage people. No problem. Sure. You're not going to make as much money. Well, actually, you can. Your salary will slowly go up. And there are several people I've met who do that. They're like, this is what I like to do. I want to do this. Now, how do you move up is generally you work on a project for X number of years. And then once that's done, there'll be a new project. And if you've been around long enough and you show a certain aptitude towards things, then you might get offered, okay, do you want to be the director on this or the co-director? Or I was the co-producer on Dinosaur King. So if I had stayed at Sega, eventually I might have been able to be the producer, the sole producer on something. So it's just time and aptitude, I guess. There are people on the Dinosaur King team, for example, one of the they call them planners here. They're just game designers. He's the director of a big music game in the arcade that's called My My. And he got there by doing enough projects, sticking around long enough.
Wow. Well, then you look at the very top of the bill of companies. I remember there was a time when Iwata at Nintendo, when he was still with us, he was facing a real challenge with the Wii U, where it was tanking the company. And instead of having any layoffs, he said that the executive team are all taking a big haircut. And they are taking in a lot less for a year so that they didn't have to have layoffs. And he made clear that the reason for this was that people can't do their best work if they fear every minute that they're going to lose their jobs. And that was a shock to us out here because we're like, Bobby Kotick wouldn't do that. Like, that's not an American thing. So is that emblematic of how people in Japan are given a sense of security, or is that just a Nintendo thing?
I think that's an Iwata thing. I don't see a lot of executives, especially boards of executives falling on the swords like that. You don't see it much.
So, Mark, you talked a bit about your experience at Koei and then moving over to Sega. How did the move to Sega go about?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I was at Koei, and, Koei is notorious for... It was fine. I enjoyed it. But they're notorious for having some of the cheapest salaries in the industry. They're super frugal. This, rich people love to be cheap. And sure enough, the Edikawas were super
exploit cheap. The workforce.
Exactly. Nothing trickles down. Okay. So, then I was talking to, I don't know, if we name drop here, but Clay Vorlich. You remember Clay?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's a friend of mine, and he would come to Japan quite often. And he said, you know, I told him, Koei's kind of, I kind of like to get into development. And he introduced me to Kumagai-san and Kano-san. He set up a dinner, just so I could meet them and talk to them. And it was cool. I didn't know much about those two, beforehand. Except I knew about Virtua Tennis and Crazy Taxi, and went and talked and had a great conversation. And then I basically got an offer after that to join Kano-san as kind of his right-hand man. And I was like, okay, cool. And the salary that they were offering me was way better than what Koei was offering me. So I told Koei I'm leaving. And then I got a call from Erikawa-san. She's like, come to my office. And so I go to her office. She's like, Mark, I heard you're going to Sega. No, Sega sucks. Sega's terrible. Koei is the best. Everybody wants to work here. It was, seriously, this is what she was saying to me. I was like, look, I enjoy it here. Koei's great. If you give me an offer that's better than what Sega gave me, I'll stay. It's like, okay, I'll talk to HR and I'll get you an offer. It'll be good. It'll be fine. Their offer wasn't even 2/3 of what the Sega offer was, and I was like, I'm out. And then, so I told her, this was, a week later or something, I told them, and then I got a call from her. She's like, okay, I understand your decision, but I want you to know one thing. A lot of people who leave Koei, they always want to come back, and I never let them back. So I was excommunicated, basically. And I was like, okay, I understand. It was a goodbye. And that was the last time I ever interacted with her. And I went to SOJ, and that was how that happened.
That's fun. It's nice to have a dinner interview.
Yeah, yeah. I've been lucky with all my job interviews, most of them. It's been that kind of thing. Where a friend gets you in.
Networking.
It's really all about, having a good, I hate the word like networking, get out there, network, but just having a good network of quality people that you like and respect and who want to introduce you to people and vice versa. I do the same thing all the time. It's really, when people ask me, how do you get in the game industry? I mean, that's kind of one of them. If you don't mind me telling another story, the way I got hired at Segasoft was very much the same. A friend of a friend, I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and a friend of a friend was working at Segasoft, and she's from San Antonio. I think it was Thanksgiving or something, she came out, there was a party, and we met, and I told her, I love Sega, I would love to get in there. Is there anything I can do? What can I do? And at the time I was working for a company in San Antonio called Globalscape. They made a piece of software called Qt FTP.
I remember that. Yep.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I was their webmaster. I'd started actually in tech support, which was miserable because this was the era where people all wanted to put their stuff on eBay, but eBay didn't let you upload images. You had to have your own FTP server and upload to the FTP server and then put a link in the posting. And, people who wanted to get on eBay were like old grandmas who wanted to sell their jars of buttons or whatever, and belt buckles and stuff. So you'd have these interminable, tech support calls with people who had no business using a computer. But then I showed them, hey, I can make a website. And so I did their website. And so Tina, who's a friend from San Antonio, she told her boss, AJ, about me. And I guess he was a Qt FTP user too. So he called me up. Or I called him, one of the two, and this was the best job interview ever. He's like, oh yeah, man, hey, I saw your stuff. I saw the Qt FTP site. When can you start? And that was it. I was like, what? Oh, I'm in. Sweet. And, I basically packed up my car with everything I could fit in it, drove out to San Francisco, and the rest was history. Long story short, it just comes down to some serendipity, but also knowing you know, the right person at the right time. And yeah, and that's what happened with SOJ as well.
Awesome. All right, Mark, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, my friend. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk about your experiences and your Japanese perspective. And really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, my pleasure. I had a great time. I'll come back anytime you want me.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Mark. It felt like we just had beers and we were sitting at a table chatting in person. It's a great opportunity to learn about what's going on in Japan.
Definitely. Look forward to the next time.
Cool. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And as always, hit us with any questions or things you want us to talk about. Take care.